Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. This is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from Sweden's west coast. Our website is redicecreations.com, and there you'll not only find our radio archive and subscribers section going back over a year, you'll also find news, resources, and links to interesting and important research material. And I'm glad you're here today. We have an interesting subject lined up for today's program, and we have an interesting guest on the line. From the UK, we have Andy Lloyd with us. He's a scientist, researcher, and author of Dark Star, the Planet X Evidence. Is our sun alone, or simply the major partner in a binary system? Astronomers are finding evidence that suggests the presence of an unseen companion to our sun. Discoveries in the outer solar system are so anomalous that only the viable explanation is that their orbits are being affected by an object more massive than Jupiter, the Dark Star. As implausible as this may seem, the idea of an undiscovered massive planet orbiting the Sun has many advocates within the astronomical community itself. Many astronomers are contemplating the possibility that dark distant companions commonly orbit around their parent stars. The dark star presence would also allow us to answer many questions raised by various mythologies. Modern science is simply catching up with ancient knowledge, knowledge that might just save the Earth from the abyss. And that caption comes from Andy's website, Dark Star One. That's the digit one, darkstar1.co.uk. And you need to head on over there right away. There's tons of absolutely fascinating material there for you in the news sections and in the different indexes on mythology, esotericism, and science. And this is a fascinating subject, and I'm looking forward to talking with Andy more about this and his research and his book here today. So let's bring him on and get things going here. Hi, Andy. Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio.
Oh, thanks very much. It's great to be on your show.
Thank you for coming on. It's a pleasure to have you here. There's lots to talk about today, the science, the recent findings, the mythology, and the future, of course. But I'd like to begin, you know, talking a little bit on you know, about your background on this subject, on the Dark Star or Planet X, and kind of ask you what led you in this direction to begin with.
I did a degree in chemistry. I didn't do an astronomy degree, although when I was a kid I always wanted to be an astronomer, but I ended up doing a degree in chemistry, and I went on to start a PhD in California. And while I was there, California being as it is, I got into reading lots of wonderful, wonderfully interesting and slightly off-the-road books. My mind was very sort of open to lots of different ideas at that time. And I sort of started to delve into the writings of people who were considering out-of-the-box ideas, by people like Zechariah Sitchin, and some of the other ufology authors. And Zechariah Sitchin's idea about the possibility of another massive planet in our solar system was something that I found particularly fascinating. And over the course of about 5 or 6 years, I read his material and other people associated with his work, and I started to formulate some of my own ideas related to them. And became very interested in the astronomy of the outer solar system and what appears to me to be a big gap in our knowledge of what lies out there.
Fascinating. You know, so I thought we could begin talk about the science. Maybe that's always a good place to start, and then move from there into the mythology and so forth. But you know, from the caption that I read earlier, it says that discoveries in the outer solar system are so anomalous that the only viable explanation is that the orbits are being affected by an object more massive than Jupiter. Tell us about that.
It's one of those claims which on the forefront of it just sounds so unbelievable that most people would dismiss it out of hand. But it's a very strange fact that ideas that are very strange like that, although the man on the street might consider them highly irregular and dubious, astronomers and specialists in the field are more open to those kind of possibilities because they know a lot more about the subject and they know that truth is often stranger than fiction. Scientists have been looking for a tenth planet in our solar system for over 100 years. They have been very keen to discover a very large body out there. In fact, Pluto, which was recently downgraded from a planet to a smaller class of body, Pluto was found whilst the Clyde Tombaugh was searching for Planet X. They were actually intending to find something much larger, and they hoped to find a larger body because they believed that their data showed that the outer planets, Neptune and Uranus, were their orbits were being affected by a very large body. As it's turned out, decades later, that information isn't accurate, that those planets haven't been affected by a body out there. But in the last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, some more bodies beyond Pluto are becoming discovered over time, and their orbital parameters, the movement around the sun that they have, appears to be affected by something quite strange. Now, there are a lot of theories floating about. No one's been able to explain it yet. There are a number of theories floating about, but one of the consequences of these new discoveries of these outer solar system bodies is that one of the ideas is the sort of resurrection of the idea of a Planet X body. And astronomers are really starting to take it quite seriously. It's starting to appear in, well, it has been appearing in papers in sort of serious scientific journals. And there are one or two professors who advocate this idea who have been writing their own papers as recently as 1 year ago. So, again, to summarise that, scientists are more open to this possibility. The people actually, you know, specialise in this field are more open to this than someone on the street who, confronted with the idea that there might be a Jupiter-sized planet in the solar system that we don't know about, would think that's quite mad. The consequences of the discovery of such an object are astounding, frankly.
Yeah.
If we found something out there that's that sort of size, then its ability to affect us could be profound in many ways. And it's like this rogue planet is like a sort of it fills the gap of knowledge, but it also creates, by being there or potentially being there, creates a whole new field of science. And our understanding of our place in the cosmos could be affected quite profoundly.
Yeah. So what do you think that it is? I mean, a dark star that sounds like that is actually it's kind of a dead sun, a brown dwarf or something like that. But are you saying that this is actually a planet or any clear theories about this?
Well, clarity in this particular field is not easy to put your finger on. There was a time when we all knew what a planet was and we all knew what a star was, and that was a very simple definition of either of them. But as time's gone on and discoveries have been made, it's become clear that you don't just have planets or stars. There is a huge spectrum of different bodies that don't fall into either category. Brown dwarfs are these bodies. They are large planets, but they also have stellar properties. They become large enough to emit heat, sometimes to emit light, but they are not massive enough to become stars in their own right. So some people use the term dead star for them, but I personally don't like that term because dead star sort of implies what's left over after a supernova, in other words, a white dwarf.
Yeah.
Brown dwarfs, right from the word go when they're born, are sort of failed stars. They're not quite big enough to make the grade. But what I'm advocating light in here is that we have what's called a brown dwarf, but it's a very, very small one. It's in its class. It's right down almost to the point of being sort of the size of Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be slightly warmer than Jupiter. It wouldn't necessarily emit an awful lot of light, but it would emit some heat. And it would be capable of having its own planetary system. In other words, when the Sun formed, it formed in parallel with this brown dwarf, almost like sort of a big brother and a little sister, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And the little sister has got her own little cohort of planets, and they would be warmed by this brown dwarf, and to my mind, would be quite capable of supporting life for a number of technical reasons. It's not very often when we talk in the alternative science field, we tend to try and rewrite science. There's a lot of ideas out there that take us off into the realms of the sort of imaginative fields of thought. And we sort of leave science behind for a while and start to make lots of stuff up, pseudoscience. But the Planet X idea is actually very well grounded in science as we understand it at the moment. You don't really need to sort of shelve science. You can actually see how it would all work within the framework of our current understanding. And that's one of the things that I like about it as a scientist myself. It challenges our understanding of the solar system as it stands, but it doesn't force us to drop our knowledge and to, you know, start all over again.
Mm. Yeah, you know, there are ideas even going about, I guess, that Jupiter itself actually is a, I don't know if we should call it a failed star, but, you know, an unignited star maybe, and then that this planet actually potentially could have been formed into a star at some point. And if we look at at some of the recent, you know, scientific studies that have been coming out, there was an article from BBC a while back, I think it was in March this year, talking about that most solar systems out there actually are binary. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely correct. If our solar system is a singular star system, it's really quite unusual. And this is one of the exciting sort of movement within our knowledge about how things work. Stars are born in sort of what are called stellar nurseries or nebula. And they are the accretion of matter within the nebula. And that matter itself came from explosions of previous stars that had died. And, you know, the galaxy appears to sort of go through a massive recycling process all the time. It's constantly turning itself over. So you have a star, it goes through the process, it explodes, the scattered remains of all the mass from the star, which become heavier due to the explosion, they reform new stars and new planets. And, you know, we're all on this planet. We were once part of a star, in effect. You know, the atoms and the molecules that make us up were once part of something rather more profound many, many billions of years ago.
Yeah.
So within these nebulae, the suns sort of get built out of clumps of condensing matter. And the binary idea, which, you know, from observation appears to be the norm, is that these clumps of stars that are forming, they form reasonably close to each other, and oftentimes they form interacting with each other right from the word go.
Hmm.
It would be very unusual, for instance, to have a star that captures another star or captures a planet. That would be phenomenally difficult to achieve.
Hmm.
But what often happens is they form in conjunction with each other. And my simple sort of, really simple hypothesis on this is that the dark star, this little brown dwarf, which is too dark for us to spot, but I'm quite certain it's out there. It formed in this nursery close to the sun and just started off orbiting around it right from the word go. And when it was born, when this sort of Jupiter-like planet, but a bit bigger, was born, it's very similar to what you were saying about Jupiter. It's probably more massive than Jupiter, maybe 5, maybe 10 times more massive than Jupiter. And that was just enough to create enough mass to create the internal gravity to set reactions going that would produce light. So at the beginning of the solar system, right at the birth, this object would have been visible in the sky, you know, even at a great distance, because it would have been shining really very brightly.
Mm-hmm.
But after a few million years, just when the star's just sort of getting going, it's quite young really, it would have used all its fuel up because it's not big enough to sustain it, and it would have gone dark. So the only point where it would have been sort of truly visible as a binary star system would have been right at the beginning in the first 5-10 million years of the solar system.
Mm.
And that's how we know that there's so many brown dwarfs out there, because when astronomers are looking at other stars, when they look into the nebulae and they see the stars forming in the star-forming regions, they often spot these very, very young, early brown dwarfs, which are very bright. And from that, they can extrapolate the fact that there are an awful lot of these objects out there.
Mm.
And it seems to me to be highly likely that one of them's orbiting our sun. The only argument against it is, of course, why haven't we spotted it yet?
Yeah, exactly. But we actually might have spotted it if we go back to, again, a BBC article from August the 20th. The headline reads, "Rare dead star found near Earth." And this is actually a neutron star that astronomers spotted. And they nicknamed it Calvera, I think. I can't remember the entire article now, but I noticed that you had this article up in your news section. Do you think that this is the potential, you know, is the one, so to speak?
Well, these objects aren't particularly easy to spot. So even though they're quite close to us, I mean, I think that particular neutron star is something like 13 light years away. I mean, it won't be in the solar system, but it's, well, obviously not, because we'd all be talking about it. But it wasn't spotted before now. And you would expect a neutron star that's in the sort of reasonably close vicinity of our sun to be something that's spotted. But, of course, these are quite dark objects.
Mm.
So it's well known amongst astronomers, well known, that between here and the closest star, which is Alpha Centauri, or Proxima Centauri in the Centauri system, between here and there is a great possibility of finding brown dwarfs. And it's also known to astronomers that the influence of our sun extends to almost a quarter of that distance. So if you've got a good chance of a brown dwarf being found within 4 light years, a very good chance, you know, better than even odds, and then a quarter of that distance is actually within the influence of the sun,
mm.
you can start to see that from a sort of even just a statistical basis, there could well be a brown dwarf within the solar system.
Hmm.
But I'm arguing something a bit more exciting than that. my argument is that this object is actually reasonably close to us, that it orbits within the boundary of what's called the Oort cloud, which is the comet clouds in the outer solar system, and that it sweeps out an area that makes a sort of gap between the Oort cloud and another band of asteroids and comets, which is known as the Kuiper Belt.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And between those two zones, this is where I believe this object resides. But in the next few years, they will find it, because they're sending up some excellent equipment, which is designed to find brown dwarfs. And I think that, if it's out there, it's going to be found in the next few years.
Really?
It's very exciting.
Wow, that's fascinating. Speaking of the orbit of this thing here, or the cycle, is this an ecliptic thing that so it kind of goes in and out of our solar system, or what is the orbit like?
Well, the idea is that certainly from some of the other authors that have discussed this subject, is that the dark, well, what I call the dark star, but what many people would term as Planet X, has an elliptical orbit, and it moves around the sun in a very similar way to the comets. So occasionally it will come reasonably close to the sun, if not within the sort of planetary zone as we understand it, which would be quite a sight. I mean, if you can imagine If you think about, say, Hale Bopp or Halley's Comet, when they appear in the sky and they're quite bright white objects, well, if you can imagine that, but then you think of it as being sort of Jupiter-sized, if it were to appear in the solar system, it would have a sort of, it would be a red planet or purpley red. It would have a huge halo around it, which would be comet-like, which would, you know, sort of extend backwards away from the sun and be blown back by the solar wind. And it would possibly have some other planets with it, which would glitter as well. So it would be an incredible sight. The contention is, and I support this contention up to a point, but the contention is that this dark star, this planet X, appears periodically in the solar system from its sort of long-distance comet-like orbit. And when it does, it potentially creates havoc in the solar system.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this massive planet suddenly sort of cruises in and lights up the sky. And, you know, the contention is that in ancient times, this thing was seen and became mythologically an extremely important object. It was basically actually called the Lord. You know, it arrived and took on religious connotations. People considered it to be either the harbinger of catastrophe, cataclysm, doom, or the sort of return of the Lord and salvation and renewal and resurrection.
Yeah.
So mythologically, it's extremely important. And scientifically, that's possible. You know, it is possible for an object even the size of Jupiter to move through the solar system without disrupting the other planets, such as the size of the space between us and the nearest planet, or, you know, or the other planets between them. You know, it's a vast area around the sun, and something could move through there without creating sort of long-term changes to the orbits of the planets. So scientifically that's possible, but it's also quite possible that this object doesn't actually come amongst the planets, that it's not actually seen, but that it has an effect on us in other ways. So there are a number of possibilities, the most exciting and interesting, of course, being one that periodically appears in the sky.
You know, one thing I wanted to get into here, I don't know if you've been researching or looking at this, but I know that when they sent up the Pioneer 10 and 11, I think it was, that was about something like 30 years ago, and these two are reaching the outer limits, I guess, of our solar system. But there was some kind of surprise, some strange force that actually, I don't know if they prevented these, you know, these sondes from actually reaching further out. Have you looked at this at all?
Yes, the Voyagers particularly, I think the Voyagers themselves have sailed on quite happily, but I think the Pioneers created a little bit of anomaly, and there were a couple of other probes that had the same. One of them was Ulysses. I can't remember the fourth one off the top of my head, but there were several probes which appeared to, actually a bit more than appeared to, the data coming back for them showed that they were slowing down, that they were moving away from the sun at a slower rate than they should have been. And it would appear from that either physics as we know it was wrong, which actually a lot of scientists said, scientists looking into this problem of the slowing Pioneers said, well, maybe there's another physical effect going on here that we're not aware of, or our sun was exhibiting more gravity than it should have been, which is a very interesting idea. These objects were slowing down, and what my contention is, of course, that they were being affected directly or indirectly by this other body out there, that it was creating an anomalous effect. Now, it could either be an effect, a direct effect, as in the gravitational effect of that body was altering the trajectory of the Pioneers, which seems a little bit wild, or it could be that the extra gravity, or the extra mass of this object, which is an unknown quantity, added into the overall gravity of the solar system, was creating the extra bit of gravity that was pulling them back. So if you like, if you take the sort of mass of the solar system in entirety, scientists who haven't discovered the dark star yet are simply tossing up all the masses of what's already available here that we know about. But when you throw in the extra mass of this planet that we don't know about, then the gravity of the entire solar system actually increases, which is enough to pull them back. So this was my argument. But actually there was a second effect which came to light a year or two ago, which in its way, to do with the pioneers and voyagers, which in its way was even more dramatic, and that is that the sun is surrounded by a field, sort of electromagnetic field, and this field, it sort of subtends out to the point where it's solar wind, the sort of driven particles, high energy particles that are driven off the sun by its sort of nuclear explosions. They rush through the solar system, and the field that's created by this activity extends, I think it's about 80 times the distance from the Earth to the sun, so what's called 80 astronomical units. And it creates a natural barrier around the sun called the heliopause. Now, this barrier was traversed by these probes recently. And what was discovered, because unfortunately not an awful lot of data can come back from these things, but it's just enough to figure out where they are. What was discovered was that the heliopause, the sheath that lies around the sun, was not uniform. It was not sort of broadly circular, well, broadly spherical. It was not exactly spherical, but it was misshapen. And this caused another bit of a stir in the astronomical community, because although there are only a few data points from each of the probes, they were indicating that this sheath, this heliopause, was not the right shape. And again, you have to ask, it's another anomaly that's presented recently, you have to ask, what on earth could be creating that effect? What on earth could be reshaping the solar system at such a great distance? So again, it's another sort of piece of evidence that suggests that there's something out there that we're not aware of at this time.
Do you have any idea where it might be now, and you know how far away it is from us?
I've got my own idea of where it is now, far away it is, and there are other researchers in the field who have slightly different ideas, and I'm not really in the business of saying I definitely know where it is, but my favoured place is that it's in the area of the constellation Sagittarius, I sort of give my reasons at reasonable length in the book, really, but there are a number of reasons for that. One of them is astronomical anomalies that have appeared in the last few decades that sort of indicate that there might be something in that direction. And another thing is the myth of the reappearance of the planet, or the dark star, or the huge comet, or whatever it might have been understood to be. And working backwards from some of the mythological sources which are available, I would suggest that this object lies in the region of Sagittarius. What makes that more interesting is that Sagittarius is a very, very difficult constellation to find anything in. It's very, very busy. It's looking into sort of almost the heart of a galaxy, really, and it's a very busy area because you're looking straight into the Milky Way. It's almost like trying to find one tiny little source of light amongst a million light bulbs. So that area it seems commonsensical to me that if we've missed something, if we haven't spotted an object that we should have done, that it would be buried in amongst lots and lots of other objects, which make it more hidden. One of the ideas to think about with this is the fact that oftentimes, or reasonably often, astronomers have catalogued certain very faint sources of light as being a star at a certain distance or a certain magnitude star. And when they've come to sort of, with better equipment, come and have a look at it again some years later, they've realized that it was misinterpreted and cataloged erroneously.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way as that neutron star that you talked about earlier on,
mm-hmm.
There's also been at least one red dwarf that was thought to be a background star in the Milky Way that turned out to be a very, very small star that was much, much closer to us.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the possibilities about the dark star is that it actually has been discovered, and that it is what it's thought to be a background star that sat in a catalogue somewhere, sort of unloved, and it turns out to be this object that's quite dark but very, very close to us.
Mm.
And Sagittarius, for me, would be an excellent place for that to happen, because for a couple of technical reasons, it's a very, very difficult area to look at,
mm-hmm.
especially in the northern hemisphere. It's not a constellation that lends itself to discovering tiny objects.
So this is...
To back that up on a sort of scientific level,
mm-hmm.
because people might think, oh, he's just making that up. When the chaps and the ladies who... astronomers who are working to try and find very, very small and new bodies beyond Pluto, where they work, they don't tend to look into the bright constellations. They purposely pick dark constellations, which are bereft of stars, like Pisces, and they point their scanners and their telescopes in those directions because they're more likely to be able to find objects. And it sort of gives you an indication that, you know, if... if an object is in an unpopular place to research, it's less likely to be discovered. And I think that's probably what's happening here.
That's interesting. So again, this is coming from the center of the galaxy almost then?
Well, it lies in the center of the galaxy. I mean,
if
you just sort of, you know, your eye, when it looks out into space, it's picking up light that's travelled from a number of different distances. And if you look at the moon, and you look beyond the moon to a planet, and then you look out towards the stars, the light's coming from a number of variable distances. And, you know, if the moon's in Sagittarius, then the light from the moon's coming from the direction of the centre of the galaxy, but it's coming from the moon.
Mm.
And this is the same with this object. It lies and doesn't really move very much from where it is. It's just sort of sat there.
Mm.
And its light could be coming effectively from the center of the galaxy, but it's actually reasonably close to us, astronomically speaking. And this is why I think it's in that particular region. It's just surrounded by other light sources of similar nature, and it's simply very, very difficult to pick up as being, you know, an object that's close to us. But that's what I think that's going to be found. So when you're looking for brown dwarfs, you don't tend to look in the light at all, the light regions. You tend to look in the infrared. You look for heat sources.
Yeah.
Because their light emissions are very, very dim. And in this, the instance of this particular thing, it would simply be the light reflected back from our sun, really.
Mm.
But the heat signature of it would be more of a giveaway. But scientists find that very, very difficult to achieve because, obviously, here on Earth, we're surrounded by heat. And even in the coldest regions of the planet, there is still background radiation, there's still background warmth, even though you need to get into space, you need to get telescopes into space to even have a decent chance of picking up these very, very sort of small telltale infrared signatures.
Mm-hmm.
And although there are infrared telescopes on the ground, they're not nearly as effective as the ones in space.
Hmm.
Now, the last time astronomers looked for infrared signatures was called IRAS back in the mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been over 20 years since we've had a decent sky search for infrared objects. And in a few years' time, we're going to have another one. And I think that one, which is called SIRTF, that'll be the one that picks this object up.
Okay, yeah. You know, I've heard other, speaking of Planet X and so forth, that the observatory at Mount Graham near Safford in Arizona, this is known as the Vatican Advanced Technology Telescope, and I've heard that they actually search in the infrared spectrum. This might be wrong. I have no idea. Have you heard about this?
I wasn't aware that they'd search in infrared. I think that would be extremely difficult given that they're in the middle of Arizona.
Yeah.
The infrared scopes that I'm aware of tend to be sat on the top of very cold mountains or are at the poles. And there's, you know, been quite a lot of talk recently about a telescope, infrared telescope down in the Antarctic, for instance.
Yeah.
And you really need to put them in particularly cold areas because you need to, otherwise your infrared search is just ruined by all the background heat.
Pick up the heat, okay, you know, yeah.
Exactly. So in the same way, for instance, that I'm going slightly off the tangent, but it gives you sort of a general feel of it from another instance.
Mm-hmm.
When the SETI astronomers are trying to pick up signals of extraterrestrial life using their scopes, every so often they'll pick up a signal that will move across their scopes and then they'll know that that's due to a satellite. You know, there are man-made conditions out there that you have to eliminate in your search, and there are also background radiation and background heat signatures from the planet. So the only real chance you've got of doing a decent infrared search is to get something up in space, and quite why it's taken them 23 years to put another infrared scope up into space is quite beyond me, really, because the IRAS search was not complete, and not only was it not complete, but they sort of never really finished up looking at all of the details of the findings that they did get. They ran out of money before the project could have been finished, and it was all sewn up before all the data was properly analysed.
Hmm.
It's not uncommon, but a lot of people talk about IRAS as being, oh, well, if there was a Planet X out there, IRAS would have picked it up.
Hmm.
And they're somewhat unaware, or they give too much credence to the idea that the IRAS wasn't perfect. Now, the new scope that's going up, that's going to be, I don't know how many magnitude times more powerful than IRAS was, but it's certainly going to be a lot better. I think it's about 1,000 times better than IRAS.
So,
you know, as long as you do the job properly with the thing, then it should pick up objects like planets orbiting the sun that we haven't spotted yet. It's quite an exciting possibility.
Wow. Did you say, when is this going up again?
I'm not entirely certain, to be honest, but I'm not sure where the launch date is, but it's in the next 2 or 3 years. It's sort of in the building stage, I think.
Okay.
These projects tend to take quite a long time. They get planned,
they
get built, and then they get launched, and then they take a year to calibrate and collect the data, and then the data comes back, and that takes another year to, you know, even after the launch of the thing, it's going to be some years before there's sort of useful data from it. So it's going to be a little while, but the point I sort of make with this is that from a scientific point of view, my case is provable, and it's also disprovable. And a lot of alternative knowledge is almost built around a hypothesis that you can neither prove nor disprove, but this one you can. In the next few years, if that scope and another one called WISE don't pick this object up, then either you've got a massive conspiracy theory going on, or it's simply not there. And it will just put the whole subject to bed. But, you know, personally, from my point of view, I think they'll make some quite interesting discoveries, and I think that they'll find a few things that they weren't expecting.
Fascinating. And, you know, that's kind of the most I think we can get out of the science bit for now. And if we kind of move towards the mythology bit a little bit here, and just, you know, one thing that I want to run by, of course, before we do that is, you say that this object, you know, potentially then is you know, has heat and light coming out from it. Potentially there's could even be planets around it. An obvious question here is then, you know, could these planets be habitated, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. The potential for life around this thing is very high. Around Jupiter, there are four major moons, the Galilean moons, which were discovered by Galileo way back when. And in fact, his discovery of those moons was the thing that sort of bed to the idea that that the sun ran went round the Earth. So it's a very important discovery, and potentially even more important than that is the possibility that those moons have life on them.
Mm-hmm.
At least one, possibly three of them, are oceanic. You know, they've got large oceans of water sat underneath large ice sheets, and they're like sort of almost like billiard balls.
Mm-hmm.
They're super round. They've got these massive thick ice sheets, but underneath the ice, the gravity of Jupiter sort of drives tidal currents and warming effects from its fields that create these oceans. And of course, life could well be found underneath them, and there's quite a lot of evidence for that.
Mm.
You'll have to wait until the probe goes up to Europa at some point to find out. But there's a very distinct possibility, a scientific possibility, that life exists around there.
Mm.
Now, if you take the dark star as being a larger than Jupiter world, a heavier than Jupiter world, which is a little bit more active than Jupiter, it's not like the sun, it's not bursting with light, but it's creating a bit of heat. It's a little bit more excitable than Jupiter, and you put moons around it which are similar to Europa, or possibly even the size of Earth, and you put them at the right distance, then in the same way that Europa's warmed up by Jupiter, those planets would be warmed up by the dark star.
Hmm.
And I would contend that you could have the right conditions quite easily where you wouldn't have to just have an ocean underneath a sort of billiard ball type ice sheet, that you could have a surface world like Earth, which is sufficiently warmed to have surface oceans, atmosphere, and so on. And that would create the potential for life to exist on the surface of a world there. So this is my contention. Now, some people argue, well, that's all very well and good, but without sort of a good source of light, how on earth are you going to really get life kick-start? You need light to produce the energy. And now we know that that's not necessarily the case, that life can exist under very extreme conditions. And also we are aware that photosynthesis can occur in quite dim, dark areas underneath oceans and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So there is great potential for life to exist out there, almost to sort of the comet fields, if this dark star idea is workable. And that leads on to other sort of more, how do we put it, less scientific ideas,
sure,
and more speculative ideas to do with the existence of aliens.
Yes, indeed. Exactly, and you know, that's a fascinating area, and let's, you know, indeed go there and explore that, because that's what this is all about here. You know, and speaking of the mythology here, going back to how things were on this planet before, there are a lot of references in different mythologies from around the world, of other planetary bodies in our solar system. We have Tiamat, we have Malkut, some is referred to as Milona, I think. We have Nibiru, of course, and Planet X, or the 10th planet. And there's even stories that seem to indicate that our solar system looked a lot different in regards to the distance between the planets, X number of millennia ago and so forth. But, you know, speaking again of the mythologies here, which one have you looked at in regarding to the dark star?
Well, Sitchin's work, Zechariah Sitchin's obviously a firm favourite. You know, he interpreted the writings of the ancient Sumerians and the Babylonians as being literal, that they were writing about gods amongst them, and that the gods came from another planet, and if you interpret the text in a certain way, it points to being a planet that we're not aware of that's in the solar system.
Mm.
And the text that he points at are called the Enuma Elish, which is the creation myth of the Babylonians. As you're saying, it's talking about Marduk, and the planet that's described, or the lord that's described, is described in ways that are clear. clearly sort of reminiscent of a brown dwarf. You know, it's sort of red and fiery and angry, and it uses lightning strikes, and it gets, you know, it gets sort of angry with the other gods or the other planets and comes hurtling amongst them and causing havoc. And, you know, it's very much in keeping with the sort of scientific scenario that I've been painting with this show. And, of course, Zechariah Sitchin's are similar, but Sitchin sort of argues that this planet's a smaller one, that it's not what I would argue as a brown dwarf. He says it's always just a regular planet. But that's got problems attached to it in my mind. But as you say, that there are other people who've developed these ideas in different directions. And before Sitchin, Emmanuel Velikovsky was writing along similar lines. And as you say, he was writing about myth pointing to lots of differences in the solar system, which and he sort of advocated the birth of Venus, and he advocated the appearance of a red comet that got so close to Earth that it sort of affected its orbit and affected its tilt and so on, and created catastrophes on this planet. Now, if you see, you're into two phases of thought, they're quite different really, but either of them, you could pick and choose flavors from them and sort of come up with a sort of reasonable theory on this. And it does seem likely to me that the idea of appearance of a sort of an anomalous red star in the sky, that would have a major effect on our people, the people of this planet, whether it was connected with alien gods who visited us or not. And I suppose Velikovsky would argue, well, it was just it impacted on us through its physical effect. You know, this thing appeared in the sky. It was huge. It affected the Earth. There were great plagues and catastrophes. And our sort of folk memory, our long-term memory as a people, has carried on the stories of this that were eventually wrote down in the Bible and so on. And that it had a catastrophic effect on us, even if, you know, there was nothing in the way of life connected with it. And Sitchin would argue, well, this thing appears, it may or may not have a catastrophic effect. That's not nearly as important as the fact that from that world came beings who interacted with us and, in fact, sort of evolved us genetically to the point where we'd sort of be able to stand on our own 2 feet and form civilization and effectively populate the world, as we have done in the last 6 years, 6,000 years. So, you know, I can go with either of those. You know, maybe there are aliens on Nibiru, maybe there aren't. It depends on how you want to interpret things. Personally, of the two, I favour Sitchin. I quite like what he has to say. But even if we're not genetically modified monkeys and we did evolve from the apes, and that we've never been visited by aliens at all, there is still the possibility this object appears in the sky, has dramatic effects, and becomes a source of reverence for ancient people. So you can have it both ways, really.
That's right. What about the idea that this planet actually was destroyed? I mean, I've heard different researchers talking about, you know, that we can see remnants or evidence for this planet, you know, in the gap between Mars and Jupiter, where the, you know, asteroid belt is now. What about that idea?
Well, I mean, Mr. Sitchin sort of goes along that route insofar as he advocates the idea that the Earth was a larger planet that was between Mars and Jupiter, and that it actually got hit by one of the moons of Nibiru, and it was its orbit was sort of knocked towards the sun. I mean, it's a difficult argument to make. You couldn't make it from the point of view like Violet Velikovsky, where you say, well, that's something that happened recently, because obviously Sitchin's arguing from the point of view of something that happened billions of years ago. So if we had a folk memory of that, it would have to have been taught to us. It would have to have been the science of the Anunnaki. The gods came to us and they said, hey, you know, this is how the world was made, this is what happened to it, and, you know, this is our creation story that we're going to tell you based on our science. They would have had to have figured out from, you know, 4 billion years ago that that's what happened to the Earth. Now, fact can be stranger than fiction, that there is scientific evidence that actually backs this idea up. Two things back this idea up. One of them is the fact that 3.9 billion years ago, about half a billion years after the start of the when the sun came into being, there is evidence on all the surfaces of the planets that there was a massive bombardment of comets, asteroids, what have you. These objects came through the solar system and caused great catastrophe. They were huge, they crashed into the Earth, they crashed into the Moon. Most of the cratering that we see on the Moon occurred during that period, and it's called the Late Great Bombardment. And scientists remain, I think it's fair to say, at a loss to explain why it was that this particular cataclysm occurred so long after the formation of the solar system. You know, the planets formed, they moved around a bit, they bashed about a little bit, and then they would have settled down. And then after a period of having settled down into nice stable orbits, this comet swarm comes in and causes absolute pandemonium. And of course Sitchin's work sits very well with this, because he would advocate that what happened was that this rogue planet, this Nibiru, this Marduk, came crashing into the solar system, knocked Earth, and sent comets flying off everywhere. It sent a huge amount of debris flying off everywhere, which was this bombardment. And he also argues that, you know, Uranus not knocked over and certain other things like that. It's quite an attractive idea. I mean, it makes sense of a lot of things. There may be other mechanisms that explain it. So that's one of them. And then there's a second thing as well, which is another weird thing, and that is that our Earth has oceans. Now that sounds one of those things, well, of course our Earth has got oceans. I mean, it's obvious we've got oceans. But actual fact, we shouldn't have, really. Our oceans, our planet formed too close to the sun for the amount of water that is on the surface of this planet to still be here. All the water should have been driven off. There should be, effectively, a pretty barren world. It shouldn't have all this water. So in order to explain where all the water of the oceans has come from, scientists often argue, oh, well, it was placed here by, well, you know, once things cool down a bit, it was placed here by comets, which are big, you know, sort of balls of ice and rock, crashing into the surface of the Earth, crashing into the atmosphere, and displacing water here. But the problem with that is that the isotopic nature of water, you can analyze it, and it doesn't quite tie up. And there are reasons, scientific reasons, to suspect that our planet actually formed further away from the sun than it is now, cooled down away from the sun so that the heat of the sun couldn't drive off the ocean, and then either migrated here or was sort of coalesced from other bodies. So again, science sort of meets this catastrophic idea of a planet that was destroyed between Mars and Jupiter, and ties us in with it. It's quite interesting, really.
Yeah, very interesting. And you know, again, I think that ties back to the idea of Tiamat, who released the waters, you know, the mother planet, basically releasing the waters of that planet onto Earth or our planet, which may have even have caused, you know, there potentially might not have been life on this planet before this actually happened. Who knows?
Yeah, the fossil records of life suggest that life started off before the cataclysm and survived it, which is phenomenal, really. It takes some getting your head around, because this would have been an extremely primitive form of life. It wouldn't have particularly been sort of organisms or what have you. But there are suggestions in the sort of geological record that sort of the processes of life formation began before the catastrophe arrived. And, you know, there was another catastrophe earlier on than that as well, where the moon was born from a sort of an object the size of Mars whacking into the Earth. And the moon was sort of thrown, Earth material that was thrown up into orbit and sort of coalesced and formed the moon. And, you know, these catastrophes, they seem to have have been, you know, Earth seems to have ridden them out. But then you sort of, you come right back down to the discussion of where life comes from. Is life on this planet evolved here and nowhere else? Was it just a pure fluke? Or is it something that arrives from outside that sort of seeds all the worlds, and, you know, Earth just happened to be sort of ripe for sort of the formation of varied sort of life? Personally, I think that's probably true. Mm. I think even if the Earth started with life, then got crunched, and all of life was eradicated as a result of a massive, you know, cataclysm, once the Earth sort of got back on its feet, Earth could have been reseeded by comets and started off again. Life could have been reseeded by comets and life on Earth could have started again. So, so that's probably, I think, what's probably happened. But who knows? No one knows for sure at the moment.
That's right, but that's absolutely fascinating. And you know, I think that this is a good time to round things off for the first segment here, Andy, and take a little break. But we're going to continue talking in the next segment and go further, you know, into talking about these cycles and if this potentially is something that is, you know, recurring, coming back. Talk a little bit about the future, of course. 2012, is there a connection with the end of the Mayan calendar? There's much more fascinating stuff to talk about here, but before we break this segment, tell people about your website and how people can get your book, Dark Star.
My website's been running since 1999, so it's sort of well-established website, and it's very easy to find because you can just Google my name, Andy Lloyd, or Dark Star Theory, and you'll find it. It's sort of very well-established in that way. But if you want the web address, it's www.darkstar1.co.uk, so it's darkstar1.co.uk, and it's quite a simple web address. My book was published in 2005 by the Timeless Voyager Press in California, and it's available through Amazon.com. And again, a search on Amazon for Andy Lloyd will bring the book up, no problem at all. Or it's available through me, and details are on the website. And obviously, people in Europe who want to get hold of the book, it's just as easy to get it from me in the UK as it is to order it from Amazon.com over in the States. So that's how you can get hold of the book. And the book is full of scientific evidence and material, but also it's full of lots of conjecture, and it discusses about Sitchin a lot, and it discusses about Planet X in all kinds of ways. And you'll find lots of fascinating stuff. A lot of people read it and really enjoyed it, so it's a good read.
Absolutely, and head on over right away to that website. As I said in the introduction, there's lots of material on there to read and discover, also about mythologies, the esoteric connection, and of course also about the science itself. So head on over there, darkstar1.co.uk. But we'll take a short break now, and we'll be right back. You've been listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. Don't miss the excellent continuation of this interview for our subscribers. Andy and I are not only going to get into the whole question of the end of the Mayan calendar, and if there is a connection between 2012 and the Dark Star or Planet X, but we'll also discuss the return of the gods and the Dark Star in connection to Freemasonic symbolism, the Anna Lucius calendar, and alchemical artwork. We're also going to talk about Parcellus and the origins of or foundings of the Rosicrucians, and if there is a possible connection to a comet or a supernova that was spotted back in the late 1500s, early 1600s by Kepler, John Dee, and Francis Bacon. Very interesting continuation of this interview that you don't want to miss. So head on over to redicecreations.com and pop into our radio archive to sign up and tune in. My thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren, and thank you for tuning in. Upcoming guests on Red Ice Creations Radio, we have Wayne Herschel from thehiddenrecords.com back on the show for some very interesting material about the secret key of Solomon and the forbidden star map of the Freemasonic tracing board. We also have author of Vatican Assassin, Eric John Phelps, lined up, and also Greg Braden. So stay tuned for much more fascinating radio coming your way soon. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, this is Henrik Palmgren. We'll see you online.
Disappointment condition, a perfunctory prescription of an indigent mindset, a belligerent silence. We got all we need, droning out of a tin can, thinking about the rain and the recession hurt. Listen to the noise in the battery tape deck, a Judas train wreck, anonymous suspect, hovering in carbon monoxide cremations, loners was the way inside of vacant locations. The international dream bank, plugging my reactor to the fallout zone. The enemy story is a lot like mine.